more. Baby, it's not nice. I chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest my cab in the middle of it. Rest my cab in the middle. We are. Rest my cab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with my co-host.
Charlotte Littlefield. Good evening, George.
I mean, that first hour, that Dr. Judy Wood is wonderful, and she's still with us for our second hour. Welcome back to our program for the second hour, Dr. Judy Wood. You're a wonderful lady.
Well, thank you.
And, okay, this little story about Peter Jennings, could you reiterate that a little bit for our people that might have missed it the first hour?
Yeah, on the 12th of September, 2001, about 25 hours after the event, George Stephanopoulos was at the site. And Peter Jennings was in the studio, and he said to George, Jackie Judd and several others have been asking, where did all the rubble go? And George said, well, Peter, I've been asking people that. And one volunteer, Robert Gerlinski, explained it all fell down into the ground, was pulverized, evaporated. And when I say this in a presentation, people usually laugh. And I explain you have to really feel sorry for George Stephanopoulos, because he's there to tell the world what's happening, and that's the best he could do. Think about that.
Right, right.
Another thing, people tend to keep asking questions until they're given an answer. They don't know how to evaluate the answer often. They just give an answer, then repeat the answer.
Right.
And a lot of, people just then start repeating it.
Right.
Well, not to go in too far of a different direction, but in Alaska, you say that there's a magnetometer. Am I saying that correctly?
Magnetometer.
Thank you. Yeah. Do tell us a little bit about what you know about the Earth's magnetic field, what you learned.
Now, there's satellite-mounted magnetometers that measure the magnetic field coming around the Earth. It also is more sensitive to space weather. And there's ground-mounted magnetometers. There happen to be easily accessible six of them in different places in Alaska that had the data recorded. And the data was pretty quiet up until about 20 minutes before the North Tower got its hole. I make no assumptions. And then it starts, all the six sites starts trending down, and then suddenly makes a U-turn, starts trending up. That was right when the North Tower got its hole. And then it keeps going up until it suddenly goes horizontally. That was when the South Tower got its hole. It's almost like one correct for the other. And then a bit later, they start trending down, and then they turn down a huge amount. I mean, like they dropped off, all the values dropped off the cliff. That was when the North Tower, the South Tower first, went away, then the North Tower went away. And they're haywire all afternoon until Building 7 went away, and they're all almost back to normal. There's an oscillating value in there.
Which, it ties into the way that the people, you have a chapter in your book where you address the people in the towers and how they, appeared to have died. And I thought you did it very respectfully and very in-depth and very moving.
This is a different set of data altogether. It's, the people were, they were called jumpers.
Yes.
You know, they started hanging outside of the building after the holes appeared in the building. But this weird trending began occurring before the North Tower got its hole.
Right.
But it, you know, talking and about the people, the people.
Yeah.
It was a very delicate subject to write, and it's chapter 3, and I put it pretty early on because after, you know, the billiard ball chapter, where you realize, that totally annihilates the official story. Okay, it's not that. But then people start imagining what it was, and what that, the jumper chapter does is say, no, it wasn't what you think. It's something totally different. Just kind of wipes the slate clean. But to realize there are over 1,200 people that left the building out the windows. I'm not saying jump. I don't think it was a conscious jump. It was certain death, and the firefighters, poor firefighters, that was the biggest torture ever.
Yes.
I think the worst human emotion is feeling helpless. And these guys were trained to save lives, and there's nothing they could do. This actually is this one member of a group, they had to hang on to him because he was going to go out there and try to catch him. They just, you know, are so strongly geared to saving lives. The people coming out of the towers, you know, it's easy to make assumptions, but then to look at what's actually going on, you have people hanging outside the building without clothes on. They're missing pants or they're missing a shirt. That's pretty strange for office building. Also, you know, some of the firefighters commented, in 20 years on the firefighting force, they'd only once seen someone jump out of a window, and that's when they had to coax them to jump out of a second-story building into a net. But they just had never seen anybody jump out before, much less 1,200. And it was certain death that people were jumping to, but here they are dangling on the outside of the building from the 105th floor. That's the one that got me the most.
Right.
And this one guy looks like he's hanging from one hand and one foot, taking his pants off.
Right.
Outside the building.
Were there reports from some of these jumpers that they were burning up, their bodies were heating up or something? Was there a report like that?
No.
There's Melissa Doy who called 911.
Yeah.
And said, really hot, burning up, I can't breathe, You never once heard her cough.
Right.
First I thought, this is a hoax, you know, but then I started realizing, no, there's something else going on here. That, you know, she thought she couldn't breathe. She actually believed it for whatever reason. She thought she was burning up. But it's something I took out of the book at the last minute, and I shouldn't have taken it. I wish I'd left it in. It's a personal story. I used to swim every morning at Virginia Tech. And this one night that these fraternity guys were joking around, they got a hold of the thermostat, and they thought it'd be fun to dial it up to, you know, peg it at the top. And the pool was, I think it was 92 or 93 degrees.
My God.
We got there in the morning, and the pool people said, oh, swim at your own risk. You're assuming you're, hey, I hate getting in cold water. This can be fun, right? So I get in, and I get halfway across the pool, and I realize I'm in trouble. I'm producing more heat than I can get rid of. So I rolled over on my back just to relax and quit making more heat. I was coasting, and somebody threw me a rope. I mean, it was like swimming in honey. And I remember thinking, I don't know if it's worth it. That's too hard to reach for the rope. Because
right.
You feel like you're in honey. It's, you're exhausted. So,
oh,
what, you know, and then you realize, though, there's a limit to how long you can stay in a hot tub.
Okay.
Or a sauna. And you know the reason for that?
What's that?
Your muscles stop functioning. If you're too hot, that your body doesn't, you know, your nerves don't fire right and all, and you can't make the muscle go. So you wouldn't be able to get out of the hot tub.
Right.
So that's why you can't stay in the hot tub over a certain amount of time. And I sort of experienced that being in that hot pool. You know, it was just really hard to reach over and get, is it worth that trouble? Your body doesn't function the same way. Now let's go back to Melissa Doy. It's really hot, I'm burning up, can't breathe. She's very hyper. That's not consistent with...
Right.
You expect, it's really hot, I can't. You know, that's what you'd more expect. And you never once heard her coughing or choking or her friends. There's five other people there, so they could breathe either in there. But she said she also found it was hot everywhere. She'd been, like, she checked all over the whole floor before she called in. So she'd been there for quite a while, and this conversation went on for like 5 minutes. And she was still hyper.
Right.
It's not consistent with physical heat.
Right.
Now, let's think of, just for example, I'm not saying this is what it was, but just to give a possibility of another, there's another explanation.
Okay.
We know there's another explanation, but think of microwaves.
Okay.
They use for crowd control.
Sure.
They say it's, you know, people think the, you know, water would help. Uh-uh. Makes it 100 times worse if your skin's wet or your clothing is wet. Because you're getting fried on the outside. So let's say this.
I have a personal experience. I once had to climb up. I was in the Navy, United States Navy, and I climbed up to change a navigational light. And as before I proceeded to climb up there, somebody went ahead of me with a stick, and they grounded all of the dishes. Well, one of them, after that person had come down with the stick, I climbed up with just my body without a stick, and I grounded one of them with my body. And I mean to tell you, I felt it. And I was an electrician's mate, and I'd been shocked before, too. But the feeling of grounding that dish up there in the air like that was quite – it was a full-body experience.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, but it was quickly over. I wasn't injured. It didn't stop my heart.
Yeah, I don't know if it's electrical or a satellite with a microwave or
– Yeah, I sure don't know either, but I'm guessing it was microwave in nature because of the submarine.
You feel like you're burning up?
You know – I did temporarily for a moment. It happened so quickly. It was full body. It was already in my muscles before I could do anything. It was before I even realized.
But you said
that it already kind of was happening.
I did.
But there was none. I wasn't.
But you thought you were burning up.
For just momentarily, I equated it to having an electrical charge go through you, which is a hot feeling.
Yeah.
And but it wasn't like being electrocuted or anything like that. I've never been electrocuted. I've been shocked. But it was a quick and yes, and then it was over, and I felt like I had heated any more of it, and I think I would have been in big trouble.
Right.
Yep. I think of somebody who puts their hand on a burner of a stove. They don't say, maybe I should take the hand off, you know, if it's hot.
Right.
No, their hand just
flies
off.
Yeah.
So if you're physically walking into an environment, like, you know, a microwave environment, you're out of there.
You know? Right.
Yeah,
right,
blow me off the little perch.
Oh, I tell you what.
Right.
Dr. Wood,
hang on. This is,
go ahead.
This. So if somebody is in a microwave environment, they're just jumping out of it. They're not paying attention to where they're going.
Right.
Some of those people who are, you know, on the way down outside the windows, waving their arms like wings, like, whoa, how'd I get here?
Yeah, right.
They weren't expecting to jump. They're just out there.
It seems that it happened so fast.
Well, then there was a component,
component. Your book was very true. Yeah. You treated it very well. But that was definitely my takeaway from it, was that, you know, it's within the realm of possibility. It's certainly not something that needs to be discounted at this point.
Now we have a lot of polyester.
Right, and also...
Yeah, go ahead.
Hang on. Also, the guy taking his pants off outside the building. What would necessitate hanging from one hand, 1 foot from the 105th floor?
Oh, my gosh.
To take pants off.
Yeah.
You know, if there's no smoke coming out the window, but let's say assume that there's smoke in there, and for whatever reason you want to take his pants off, you just take in a big, deep breath, you step in, you take your pants off, and then you get back out.
Right.
What necessitates taking off the pants outside the building? Imagine if they're wet. You know, if I heard the building was on fire, I'd run to the restroom to wet myself down, you know, with water, you know, before we lose water pressure, and I'd be wet. If the sprinklers kick on, you'd be covered with water and you'd be wet.
What does polyester do in microwave environment? Doesn't it heat up?
I suspect so.
So much of our clothing today is polyester. You think that's what they were heating up? You think?
That's a good point.
See?
And it, not necessarily just water, but
no,
heating up and on the surface.
Yes.
And
yes.
So they realize they need to get their clothes off
yes.
to feel better.
Yes, yes. Now, there's a psychological component I'm thinking you touched on in there, I believe, about was there a mind change, a mindset change, maybe by the, because they were in some kind of a feel system or not?
I don't know of that. I'm not going to guess that. But if the mindset being just like any human, it's not really a mind. It's a reflex. You know,
okay,
if your hands
sure,
on a hot
sure.
burner, it flies off.
Okay.
If you're in a, you know, a nasty environment that's, you know,
you want to get away from there. Get out of there, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you jump away from it like your hand flying off a hot burner.
Oh, okay.
And then suddenly they find themselves outside the building.
Sure. Sure.
That's what it sure appears as, and that's not a decision. That's just, you know, reflex. You're, and that's why they do use microwaves with crowd control, because people can't endure it. They can't stand it. They're just out of there. It flushes people, you know, out of, breaks up the crowd.
It's not a decision point.
Right.
Right.
You said there were about 1,200 jumpers approximately. Is that right?
Right, right. And that's based on, you know, averaging of what the firefighters on the ground were estimating they saw coming out the windows.
Right. Some were saying, what, one per second, one per five, 4 or 5 seconds?
Yeah,
I mean,
or,
different rates.
Three or four per side of the building per minute.
Per minute.
Out of the North Tower.
So those are the way they estimated. And some of those, that really affected those firefighters, did it not?
Yeah, having to deal with that. There's
yes.
also Elaine Gentle who called her husband from up above, and she was one of the ones who went to the restroom and had some towels that got wet wrapped around her head and was going to call her husband and said, "I'll call you when I get down to the bottom. We're starting down the stairs." And a couple of floors later, she went out the window.
My gosh. What about the bodies? Were there that many recovered on the site, or were they gone also along with the building?
The pieces. They're pieces.
Pieces. Okay. Now, the ones that jumped, it was the bigger pieces, I assume.
I'm getting the bandwidth.
Yeah. So, okay.
Some of them came apart. You still had sometimes a hand here, a foot there, an arm over there, a rib cage. It was
okay.
bizarre.
Right.
That was another issue, that people seem to be coming apart on the way down.
Right. Are you're familiar with William Rodriguez, the janitor, I believe?
Yeah.
In the North Tower there, I believe. You have a part of explosions. Were there explosions on the lower levels before the planes hit, or soon after, or what? Did you get into
that? There are explosions. I don't use his testimony because
okay.
it's scrambled, and when I find inconsistencies, then it's no longer, you know, useful
okay.
to me. But I do have plenty of evidence. You know, I go for other evidence that there were explosions at ground level.
Yes, yes.
Now, the only thing that was identified and I'm aware of that was exploding were things like the air tanks that the firefighters wear.
Yes.
So they can breathe, you know, clean air and oxygen in a smoky environment.
Sure.
They had extra tanks sitting on their fire truck, and they were just exploding.
Oh, I see.
And so how do you explain that? It's not, you know. People hear the sound of explosions, but if you put popcorn in your microwave oven, you hear the sound of explosions.
Right.
That doesn't mean you have bombs in your microwave oven.
Right. You seem to indicate that there were field systems and they were convergence and then interrupted or interfered with. Or what are some of your ideas and comments on that?
Oh, I don't have, anything like, you know, nothing concrete. But
okay.
what I do see is like those vehicles that were found in FDR Drive is one particular one.
Okay.
That you say, I don't know where it was toasted, but it was found in FDR Drive. That it has a circular spot on it that's not toasted, and the area around it is.
Okay.
And you think of a dark room, you know, where somebody's dodging some area of the photo.
Okay.
You have to go back, a few generations. Kids nowadays would understand that term, but it's a certain area that was something blocked the effect from hitting it.
Okay. Okay.
And there's or, you know, the effects hit someplace else. And my background is also in interferometry, where you interfere different signals.
Okay.
And not one or the other, but the combination is what you, where you get the effect. And so it reminded me much of that.
Right. Would there be it, reflection involved in this then from the main site out to the FDR drive or not? A reflection from the buildings or not?
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
There's other similarities. See, try to resist jumping to a conclusion and just look at what the evidence is saying.
Okay.
That, you know, let's look at how tornadoes work.
Okay.
Something can happen in one spot, and right adjacent to it, nothing happened at all.
Exactly.
That's not wind. Like a roof of a house in Texas, I think it was the 3rd of April, about almost three years ago, where you see this big screen television was fine, this bookshelf is fine, there's a stack of printer paper on the bookshelf that didn't even get ruffled up, but the roof's gone.
Crazy.
Right, right.
Wind didn't blow it off because wind doesn't have an abrupt boundary.
Now let me make a point here before we move on. The Hutchison effect could affect something that was bending 180 degrees. Were some of the beams there bent over 180 degrees on themselves or what?
Right. Yeah, more than 180 degrees.
Really?
But also, I hope you understood that other one while I was getting to the tornado.
I'm sorry.
The abrupt difference where wind would taper off. The effect would taper off. It wouldn't have, you know, one nanometer to the left is you have 100 mile an hour wind. One nanometer to the right, you have zero.
Okay.
That doesn't make sense. So there's effects like that. Just to look at the similarities of physics that we weren't taught
is
identifiable in tornadoes. And so if you get that type of, you know, apply that to the evidence you found at the World Trade Center. So now what were you asking?
Let me ask one other question real quick when we're talking about tornadoes. There was a hurricane out to the northeast. Is that right?
It was to the east and southeast.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And it had been headed towards New York City for 4 days.
Okay. How did that impact, and did it move out towards the Atlantic into deeper water, or what? What happened on that?
Oh, there was a high pressure system moving eastward. It was covering the U.S. And then the hurricane was moving westward.
Okay.
And they didn't know when they were going to meet.
Okay.
But what was peculiar about that is they seemed to be 100% sure that it wouldn't get any closer than it got, because there was no mention of it on the weather reports that morning. I mean, no mention. It wasn't on the weather map, but it was right there in the range of the weather map they were showing. And over CBS, over Manhattan, says weather is going to be as nice as can be, and it's a hurricane right there. The outer bands were over the end of Long Island, and it was raining at Cape Cod. That's how close it was.
My gosh.
And so they had to know precisely when it was going to turn around. Who knows the behavior of a hurricane that well? Otherwise, they would say, well, there's voluntary evacuation. We don't know if it's going to hit or not. No, there's just no mention, no voluntary or required evacuation.
Right.
And since then, we've had Hurricane Bill and Hurricane Irene, and you know they do these evacuations. So that was peculiar. Atlantic City, because of the high surf,
okay,
I think they even closed the beach. And they took all the ships out to sea, because of the rough sea.
Right.
So it was interesting. So, yeah, there's this hurricane, and it's peculiar that it, for 4 days, was aiming straight towards Manhattan. And on the first day, in the text messages of the weather people, they said, well, it'll turn around by morning. Next morning, it didn't. And they said, well, it'll turn around by the next morning. And it didn't. On the fourth day, they said, you know, turn around today. Something. Good thing it did. They didn't have any more time to spare.
Right.
Wow.
You know, JFK Airport's at sea level. Same with LaGuardia. Manhattan is at sea level. If that hurricane stalled out there, and when you had high tide coming in, that'd be a problem.
My gosh, it would have been a double catastrophe, wouldn't it?
Right. And then you have the, it's from the space station, Frank Culbertson has got his handy dandy, you know, camcorder, aimed down. He said, I can see the carnage from here. I'm looking down, up and down the East Coast to see if I see anything else. This was, you know, as the space station is passing over Manhattan. Right. But he had to aim that camera very carefully to not get in the outer bands of the hurricane. You kind of wonder why he didn't say, well, at least the hurricane didn't hit, too.
Right, right.
There's no mention of the hurricane.
Now, let me ask you this quickly. Was there any ground shaking before the buildings came down or any shaking of the buildings before they started, going away?
There's not really any comments on that. They're said it's not a big thing in people's minds.
Okay. And
they just notice they look up and say, run for it.
Right. Now let me. Oh, I know what the question is. The tops of those buildings, the north and south, did they blow up and outward like a little mushroom before the buildings started being destroyed?
Not really, and that's another telltale, was that tipping top of Tower 2.
Yes, yeah.
It was tipping over Building 4, and if that was a rigid body, it would have continued tipping due to laws of physics.
Sure.
You know, conservation of angular momentum would have required that thing keep going down, so it should have landed on Building 4.
Okay.
But instead, it just turned into dust in midair.
Right.
Without encountering anything. And how do we know that? Because it stopped tipping. Remember in the videos, it starts tipping and it stops tipping.
Sure.
Yeah.
To obey
it disappears.
The laws of, well, it turns to dust. But to obey the laws of conservation of angular momentum, if it stopped tipping, that means all the little particles are continuing to rotate. The thing isn't rotating as a rigid body because it's now a rectangular or a prism-shaped unit of dust, and the dust particles, each particle is rotating, and that's how it maintains the law of conservation of angular momentum.
Okay.
The fact that the building appears to stop tipping is proof that it turned into dust in midair.
Right. What was there dust that continues a similar process on the ground for days or weeks after, or what?
Yeah, the dust seemed to continue breaking down right afterwards. You see it land on the ground. You can look up and see, to the west and see clear blue sky. And then pretty soon you see this dust coming up off the ground. That dust could not have settled out of the air that quickly.
Right.
It had coarse dust that landed and then became fine dust.
Okay.
And that fine dust, which I called fumes, kept coming up from the ground.
Sure.
Continued on and on for a long period of time. And the cover story for that was smoke from fires that lasted for 99 days.
Right.
But, there's, wet dirt and these fumes coming out of the wet dirt and they're sprinkling water on it. That's not fire. There's something else going on.
Right.
Also, if it was fire, you put water on it, it would sizzle and you'd get this, water vapor coming up. It looked like steam.
But it wasn't doing that.
On rainy days, it quieted down the fuming. On dry days, more fume comes out. So that's contradicting of, fire.
Right, right. Charlotte, you got a question or comment, Charlotte?
Oh, I have plenty of questions and comments, but I'll keep sticking to a question. Concerning the Hutchinson effect, that absolutely fascinates me because I saw a lot of that. And I'm not an expert or even educated in this area. I'm just Johnny Come Lately who come across the information, and I was quite impressed with all the various effects that he gets with his, different experiments that he does.
Right.
And so tell me a little bit about how your thoughts are concerning what he's uncovered and the parallels that you see in the debris, so to speak.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, for example, just how it affected the various metals and the beams and the things that we already know that have been brought about by the Hutchinson effect that he's already demonstrated, and that what we kind of see here as well.
Well, that what he's demonstrated is, you know, I call that parallel evidence. It's reproducible, you know, if it's the same kind of effect that we see. That the metal, you know, lots of different things happen depending on you know, which knob you turn how and how you tune the you know, is it a sawtooth wave, is it a square wave, or, you know, sinusoidal, and how it's the relative powers of things. It's a definite art form. And sometimes you get levitation. Sometimes you get material, you know, disintegration. And material has ongoing degradation. It keeps coming apart further and crumbles further.
Didn't we see rust?
Yep, instant rustification, I was calling it.
Yeah, what does that happen? What happened on that?
It's, you know, we can have various questions about it. Could it be that all the iron particles in the system came to the surface, or did it transmute, you know, more in iron? When you make steel, it has various components in it, different, you know, mainly iron, but it has various other doodads, like, some nickel, some molybdenum, depending on what properties you want. If you want it to be more environmentally resistant, or, you know, stronger, or you want it, you know, there's different heat treatments. There's lots of different things, but it's not just pure iron. You got other components. So it appears that this, you know, like the different atoms that are connected. Think of musical chairs. I think all of us have played that as kids. The music's playing. You get up and walk around, and it stops, and you have to sit in a chair, but there's one chair less each time. And you have to grab for a chair. Now imagine if these atoms, while the music's playing, in other words, the field effects are in operation, that the atoms are loosely kind of wandering around, and the music stops, and they've got to grab onto something. And they may not grab on the same way. They transmute, they change from one element to another. There's evidence of that as well. But the musical chair effect, you see that in hurricanes. You know, there's straw in trees. Two before, through a palm tree. While the music's playing, the atoms aren't quite as strongly connected. Now, along comes a straw, and then the music stops playing, the straw gets stuck in the tree.
Right.
There's some other, you know, strange things that happen with that. Like you get a big, long, the thing that happened in Texas, there's an interesting video of these long beams that stabbed through a house. They just made holes, punched holes through the house, and, you know, almost went out the other side.
My.
You got to think of the dynamics of that don't really work out with, you know, a big thing like that would be tumbling along.
Right.
Like the two before through the tree in Hurricane Andrew. I've got a photo of that in the book. So it appears that during a hurricane or a tornado, these same kind of things are in effect. And it turns out I think we all know that electricity and magnetism are interrelated. They're like two sides of the same coin. You know, Cub Scouts, we'd wrap a wire, coil it around a nail, and you plug the wires into a 9-volt battery, and the nail becomes the magnet.
Okay.
And how hydroelectric power plants work is moving a conductor through a magnetic field, and voila, you get electricity flowing.
Right.
So from magnetism, we get electricity. And it turns out that gravity is also related to these.
Okay.
That they all can, you know, one affects the other. And there's been some research projects about charging up airplane wings to make the airplane fly faster. So if electricity affects magnetism, and magnetism affects gravity, then electricity affects gravity. So if you start mixing and matching with these things, you can get some strange things happening. And in nature, that's what a tornado is.
Right.
The material just comes apart.
Right. You say in your book the term directed energy weapons. What do you mean by that?
Oh, I don't say weapons.
Okay.
You know how early, you know, in the previous hour we were talking about how we can rule out the destructive mechanism being kinetic energy. We can rule it out as thermal energy.
Yeah.
Now let's think of the third thing, directed energy. And my definition of that is energy that's directed to do something differently.
Directed energy. Okay, excuse me.
Yeah. That's what I mean, directed energy. That's what I talk about. So there's something that can do what was done.
Okay.
So the fact that this was done proves that a technology exists that can do what got done. And it's amazing how many of my detractors say, well, she can't prove that such a technology exists. Well, it happened, so it does exist.
Right, it exists. And you mentioned the other day that perhaps the same technology could mediate the radiation of Fukushima.
Yep. If this transmutes material, changes things from one element into another.
Right.
Think of Fukushima. You could clean up Fukushima.
Right.
You clean up Chernobyl, but to do so would be outwardly acknowledging this technology exists.
Right.
It would necessitate that. And so, as I often say, someone else, you know, said this before, and I think it's a good statement, that it's the way it is because somebody wants it that way.
Right.
Yeah.
But why the cover of my book, you know, the title is Where Did the Towers Go? And the subtitle is Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11.
Yes, exactly.
That's showing a silver lining. I'm not talking about weaponry. I'm talking about the destructive mechanism.
Right, okay.
Showed that there's a technology that can do what was done.
Right.
Energy was directed, like we're talking about the tipping top of Tower 2 that turned into dust.
Sure.
Something directed the energy to, you know, instead of the atoms being attracted to each other, they're now repelling each other.
Right. So you
something
they,
caused them to
yeah,
do that.
They
and
could,
so that evidence,
yeah.
if, you know, it was used in horrible ways that day, but it's evidence that such a technology exists. And let's think of all the good things we could do with that. Free energy. What I mean by that is like naturally occurring.
Right. So it could break, the technology could break molecular bonding, right?
It can change.
Change it. Transmute.
Yeah. It can affect the molecular basis of matter.
Okay. And that's, what, reducing it down to more of
the technology that can do that.
It's reducing it down to more of an elemental stage or
changing it in some other way.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Let's say, you have the, playing musical chairs while the music's playing, all of the iron atoms come to the surface.
Okay.
And then you turn off the music and you scrape away the flakes, the powder of iron off the surface.
Right.
You have a different product.
Right.
You know, that's a simplified, example, but I think you get what I'm saying. There's different other aspects of it, too. But it's I don't know all of the capabilities of it, but we know what we see.
Right.
And that's why it's so important to be able to observe and to be able to think independently.
Right.
Because then you can see all sorts of, like tornadoes. We're not taught about that in school.
Right. Charlotte's brought this up over the years. It was never declared to be a criminal scene, or was it not?
It was a crime scene of sorts, but that's often used as a talking point.
Right. Okay.
That folks use, and it distracts away from what happened.
Okay. Okay.
And there's various other talking points that people tend to repeat.
Okay.
And that's kind of designed to. I'm not saying that this is what she's doing at all, but
right. But
it's a package of those things that quickly, they're people who ask questions, and as soon as they start asking questions, they end up gravitating to a group where the thoughts get dictated from the top down, and people are given a list of talking points they start repeating over and over again, and that keeps them from ever looking at the data.
Okay.
You know, first establishing what happened is the important thing. And saying, okay, Ace Elevator was in there doing some upgrades. Oh, we got to go investigate Ace Elevator.
Okay.
That doesn't tell you what happened. You got to first establish what happened. And the other things, but But people are conditioned, you know, well-meaning people get conditioned to go down these routes. And again, that's how magic shows work. People are conditioned to get distracted away from what the real problem is.
I have a question concerning the Earth magnetic field and this possible Hutchinson effect or the different things.
I'm not saying possible Hutchinson effect. Hutchinson effect is parallel evidence. It's an example.
I agree.
Of
I just don't know
phenomenon.
What to call it. Yeah, I just don't know what to call
evidence.
It.
Is there, you know,
okay, the parallel evidence.
Yeah,
I find it fascinating that there could be something strong enough that it would show up on a magnetometer, if I'm saying that right or correct again.
Magnetometer,
yeah. I mean, that has to be some sort of weapon that, or not weapon, directed energy that has phenomenal.
Maybe it's coincidence. You know, but
I guess it could be.
But with the point being, here's evidence of something happening. This is, you know, mighty strange. What about looking at it further? You know, and if, but if you're monkeying around with something, you would expect, you know, a different magnetic field to be, you know, to have a different effect to it. It's a small effect,
right.
But it's the timing is just so I often like to joke about the hole in the North Tower when it happened.
Okay.
The NIST report has one piece of time, and the seismic station has another time, and I think the 9/11 Commission had another time. They're all close, but I like to joke and say I can tell you which one was right based on the magnetometer data. It falls right between two of them.
Really? Huh. That's very interesting.
It's a strange thing.
Yeah. So it was not just one thing. There were a lot of different factors coming together. Is that sort of what you're saying here?
Well, you first have to look at all the evidence.
Okay.
And you look at the evidence, and you know, for the destructive mechanism, you know,
sure.
What caused the buildings to, you know, get destroyed.
Okay.
We can rule out thermal energy.
Sure.
We can rule out kinetic energy.
Okay.
So right there, that rules out bombs, hammers, bowling balls, banging on the building, gravitational collapse. That's kinetic energy. Thermal energy is heat.
Okay.
You know, the buildings did not melt. They turned to dust.
Oh. Right.
Things didn't burn up, so we can rule out thermal energy. And so what I mean by, you know, there's no question about the energy was directed in some way without something banging on it or, you know, putting a match under it. The energy was directed to do something differently than it normally does. And I'm calling that directed energy. The energy was instructed to do something differently. And it was instructed to do it in a certain geographical area.
Yes. It was limited to that site, right? Yeah.
Well, approximately.
Right.
And didn't we also have electrical power reports of that, of electrical power cut off moments before World Trade Center 2 went down? Or I shouldn't say went down, disappeared?
Went away. There's a lot of different reasons why the electricity could go off. But one thing interesting is that the traffic lights, you can see in some of the pictures, the traffic lights are still on and working.
Hmm.
You know, on Vesey Street. So
God.
it's kind of strange, you know, and then, you know, why, I really wondered why, you know, if you make some towers go away, that was like a whole zip code to unplug all the power. What effect would that have on the electrical grid?
My God.
Yeah, but I guess they have control mechanisms that, you know, automatic controls that can deal with that, but you think, you know, somebody suddenly unplugged all those buildings, what that would do. But surprising that was handled fine by the system.
Was there any one that experienced an individual disappearing or going to dust or anything or not?
Yeah, there's various stories. Like, I think it's Michael Macko that comes out of it. He's at the base of Building 2 when it starts to go poof. That's okay. My term for going away, whatever happens.
Sure. Yeah.
And he's making a run for it, and he dives under an emergency medical truck.
Okay.
And he dives under it, and then everything goes dark. And he talks about having to figure out how to breathe and so forth. Then he thinks he's a goner. He's buried.
Okay.
Until the dust clears. The dust clears, the sunlight can come in. He looks up, and the vehicle's not on him anymore. He has no idea where the vehicle is. He didn't remember it rolling away or flying off him. It's just not there. It's weird things like that. There's also in Building 3, Tower 3.
Okay.
That's that angled building between, in the corner between towers 1 and 2. And, they're trying to get rid of all the people who are refusing to leave their rooms. And there's, I think, a lawyer on the 22nd floor on the south end of the building, and there's some firefighters who are trying to get him out of the building. He's on his way over there when Tower 2 goes away. And as this firefighter walks along through that corridor, he's behind the building's not there anymore. It just disappeared. There's no building there.
Oh, my gosh.
And he just made it to that guy's room, and then they start going down the stairs in that south end of the building. They get down to about the second floor, and the rest of the building goes away.
Yeah.
That's, you know, the first one was when Tower 2 went, and the second one was when Tower 1 went. But, yeah, the hallway he came through disappeared. Wasn't there anymore. There's quite a few have stories like that, and then there's, can't find their vehicle. Some vehicles people couldn't find. There's 1,400 vehicles that there's enough left that they got towed away.
But there's some vehicles totally gone, disappeared.
They couldn't find. Yep.
How many vehicles did they not find at all? Did you have a number?
I don't know that number.
But there's a number. I mean, it's not just a few.
It's
quite a few, probably.
Well, I don't know that there's some that you just couldn't find the vehicles.
Right.
And then there's some interesting stories, like this one guy who is Bobby Newman. He was the last man out. And he dove under his fire truck with some of his buddies.
Yeah.
And one of his buddies say they know he was the last guy out and that he got out by the skin of his teeth because his shoes were blown clean off him.
Right. What? How did that happen? Golly.
You ask, how does somebody end up without their shoes? And I think that the shoes, from, looking at the pattern of data, they're like capacitors.
Oh, okay.
I think that's why the shoes disintegrated.
Would they have rubber? They're made out of synthetic rubber?
Well, if there's a charge in the environment,
okay,
it can only discharge through the feet.
Okay.
And if you have a kind of shoe that doesn't let it discharge as fast as coming in, then that might be a problem. That's what it seems to be.
Okay. Okay.
Just like with the vehicles. Vehicles are up on rubber tires.
Right.
And they can get a charge from the environment. They can't discharge as fast as they're getting charged. And this is something John Hutchison noticed in his work, is that the stuff that was less grounded tend to come apart and get toasted. Whatever, I call it toasted. It's toast. It's history.
Okay.
Stuff got toasted that was less grounded.
Right.
And then you also realize these towers, these big, tall things.
Okay.
So what's going to, if you have a charge in the environment, what's going to get charged up first? The upper part.
Okay.
And it can only discharge through a route all the way, down the columns.
Okay.
And so it might not be able to discharge as fast as it's getting charged.
Okay.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah,
and then you have these people remaining in Stairway B that had the most robust columns around it, and they're very well grounded.
I see.
And you have an ambulance that survives right outside of the door of Tower.
Yeah, just sitting there, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, towering over anything else that's left.
There's
something about ambulances. You get heart patients and other things like that. Have you ever gotten in a car where you get shocked when you touch the door?
Yeah.
Is the potential between you and the car. Well, they can't have that with oxygen tanks and then people with heart issues. And so they drop a chain. It grounds them.
Right. I've seen, you know, okay. How about...
And so you don't have proof that that one had a chain drop, but I would guess that that's, you know, that might likely be so as to why the ambulance was still there.
Right.
It looked like it was in pristine condition, except for maybe the door was a little bit ajar.
Right. How about health issues of the people that were working there on the pile? Now, there were a lot of cancer.
It's a debris field, no pile.
Okay.
See, that's another word that it's a type of neurolinguistic programming.
Okay.
You know, pile. No, collapse.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay.
Debris all these field. Words were put in the field. Yes, debris field.
I see. Okay.
Because your brain subconsciously starts seeing a pile there.
Oh, I see. I got you.
But they're words that we were trained into repeating by the media and so forth.
We've got a lot of, firemen that have suffered, cancer and all kinds of different ailments.
Oh,
then.
The dust contained all the constituents of the building.
Right.
If you breathe a dustified building, and it's a wonder they last as long as they did.
Right. How about asbestos? Was asbestos present in those buildings?
From what I understand, from what I've been able to find, not really. Okay. The North Tower, when they got to the 40th floor, was when asbestos got outlawed, and they had to take it all out, put in non-asbestos.
Okay.
And from the 40th floor on up, it was all non-asbestos.
Okay.
And South Tower was 100% non-asbestos from the get-go.
Okay.
So I really think there was almost, you know, essentially none there or minor amounts, but that became a scapegoat as to why people had breathing issues.
Okay. Okay.
But if you're breathing whatever was in the environment there, you're breathing in every constituent of the building.
Right. When we were talking earlier about different phenomena, snowballs and things like that, what were snowballs? Were those along the ground?
Fuzzballs.
Yeah.
Fuzzballs.
Fuzzballs.
I noticed that when people were walking, they get these, you know, this hazy dust.
Yeah.
Balls around their feet.
Really?
I call those fuzzballs.
Fuzzballs,
and that's
when
I noticed that you know, the air was clear, like up to their knee, but they had fuzzballs around their feet. And this was right after the demise of Tower 2. Tower 1 was still standing.
Okay.
And it had been less than 15 minutes. If the dust is that fine, how could it settle out of the air that fast?
Right.
And it was crystal clear in this particular guy, you know, from his knees on up, crystal clear image. But so that's why I call those fuzzballs. There's fuzzy haze. I started noticing it developed, and it became more pronounced in that 30 minutes after the demise of Tower 2, which was the first tower to go away.
Right. Were there some holes in the ground, on the base level there? The ground level.
Right. And one of the first things that I was fascinated with was the holes in the street.
Okay.
Yeah, in front of Tower 2.
Okay.
And Liberty Street. There's just holes in the street.
Just holes
in the street. Look down there. They're empty all the way down to the bottom.
Oh, my gosh.
Right, essentially empty. I mean, you get, you know, one piece of steel here or there, but, you know, that wasn't what made the hole.
Right. Gone. The material just gone. Just a hole there with no material in there. I see.
And then you look at, you know, from the top down, and you notice buildings 4 and 5 had holes in them. Especially building 5. It looked like it had bullet holes all through it, except they're like, you know, 24 feet in diameter or so.
Okay. Okay.
It was just, they're empty, you know, down to probably ground level. There's missing material, like building 4. It was a T-shaped building, and the main body of the building was the wide part of the T, and that was the south end. It was completely gone, and only the stem of the T, you know, the north wing, is all that's remaining, and it doesn't look really damaged, and it's sliced off, like somebody took a knife and sliced it off and then disappeared the rest of the building.
Golly. My God.
Like a surgical cut.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a corner of something, you know, there, but not much else. And then you see these rescue people right below that. There's a little bit of a punch to the ground, but another story below that, there's no sign that it's popped to the ground.
Right.
Where'd that building go?
It's
gone.
We've got about 4 minutes and a half to go. what would be your concluding remarks this evening?
How did we get here? We got here by turning over our thinking to someone else's keeping, believing what we're told rather than what we see. And this new world ahead of us, it's, you know, a big trick of perception management. There's no denying that there's a technology that exists that can do what was done. That technology can be used for good or for bad. It can be used to provide free energy to the world. And by free energy, I mean, you know, naturally occurring. But he who controls the energy, remember this, he who controls the energy controls the people. But he who controls their perception controls everything. So it's very important, it's vital, to control your own thinking, to be able to problem solve, and not just listen to what you're being told. That's why my book had to be written as it was. It's A Course in Critical Thinking. How to think for yourself, how to observe what is right in front of you.
It was right in front of the world.
And this is a good example of what happened in 9/11, because the majority of the planet believed what they were told, that the buildings collapsed.
Right. It's all these interpreters out here that we have, isn't it, that interpret things for us. And then we just take it for granted. But you're saying directly experience it yourself and then forget about these interpreters and then let the evidence speak for itself, but directly to you, right?
Yeah, resist jumping to a conclusion.
Okay.
Because that is how magic shows work.
Okay.
Remember, you have to first determine what happened before you determine how it happened or who did it, why they did it.
Okay.
If you jump to any step beyond the first one, you have to assume a problem and then you never solve what happened. And you're just working on an imaginary problem. That is the easiest way to control perception. So it's important to be able to understand what happened.
Right. Charlotte?
And I was going to say, and to look out for that linguistic programming, that neuro-linguistic, those words. That
we got a friend that's an expert on that. We've had him on a couple of times. David is considered to be an expert in that area.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't use that, you know, that I don't point that out so much, but that is essentially what I'm doing by creating these new words like fuzzballs, dustification.
Yes.
It gets away from that programming of, you see a haze, you call it smoke, then you're assuming it's fire.
Right.
Or a pile.
I fell into that one, yeah. I've had to be very careful in my language talking to you, doctor.
Well, that's the way I pointed out, to dip it in the bud or whatever, to stop it if you don't realize you're doing it.
Well, you're making us aware of, aren't you more aware now, Charlotte, of some of these factors?
Absolutely.
Boy, this has really been a fine interview, and I certainly thank you for being with us this evening. And we have all the click-offs up there. If there's anything else you want us to add, just email me, and we'll certainly put it up. But you've done a very, very fine job on this, and you worked thousands of hours getting this book together. And so you can go to thesecrettruth.com. We broadcast every Saturday night, 7 to 9 here in Austin on 89.1 FM. We've been on the air nearly 9 years. November 1st of this year, we'll been on the air then. But I really want to thank you again, Dr. Judy Wood, for being with us. And, Charlotte, any closing comments?
No, I just want to thank the good doctor as well. It's been quite an education. Your book is phenomenal, and I recommend it for the listeners out there to go get a copy and see for themselves.
Go ahead.
If anyone claims to be refuting this book, you can't refute evidence. People have come to call that the holy water, like what you flick on someone to see if they're a vampire.
Right. Okay. Well, Dr. Judy Wood, thank you for being with us this evening, and good night.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, good night.
Okay, good night.
Bye-bye.